Welcome to Fireside Chats, Leadership Journeys, brought to you by the Office of Academic Clinical Affairs and hosted by Dr. Carolyn Porta. These chats bring together University of Minnesota Health Sciences students with experts for candid conversation on leadership, career pathways, sources of joy, and strategies to rejuvenate.
The purpose of the Fireside Chat is to have candid, casual conversation with colleagues, with experts, to get a chance to really listen and hear. So I'm gonna start us off, and this can go to John or to Mike. Talk about right now where you are today. What's the most challenging thing that's going on in your life? How are you taking care of yourself amid everything that's going on in your life?
Whoa, big one. I guess maybe I can start. Jan and I, my wife and I have, we bubbled up when this started about a year ago. And the reason for that was in particular that our son and his wife were turned out to be having twins in July. And they have an older son who's 3 years old, and so Jan took over teaching him. She's a retired Montessori teacher. So I've tried to, you know, we've all tried to kind of stay protected and in the bubble here to help allow that to happen so that we could do that back and forth. So, but I also walk a lot and in below zero weather and whatever else. I'm fortunate to have visited both poles, and so I have all the equipment I need. And you know, when you go out with this equipment on and you're sweating and it's too hot, you know that you're doing all right, right? So that's kind of how we've managed to do it through this period of time, and I think it's really, really helped a lot in terms of our family and so forth. And I also have a mother who's 95 years old, and we help care for her in the house too, off and on. So that works anyway.
Thanks, John, very much. Mike, how are you taking care of yourself?
Well, first of all, please listen to John, okay? He's the role model here. I am not the role model. you know, I think right now I look at my life kind of like surfing the big waves at Maui, the 50 footers. If you're too far forward, you're dead. If you're too far back, you're dead. You just got to ride the wave just right. And I think right now with this situation, that's what I've tried to do since a year ago, December. And it's been a challenge in that we've been in the eye of the storm on a lot of issues. I am right now on the issue of one dose versus two doses of vaccine with a delayed dose. Right now, our numbers, which I think have been accepted now even by the White House as the legitimate numbers, is that as it is right now, as we're vaccinating, 30 million Americans 65 years of age and older will not have vaccine by April. And this new variant is surely going to be a major challenge, the B.1.1.7. We're seeing markedly increased transmission. We're seeing markedly increased severity, hospitalizations, and deaths. And this could be by far the darkest days of the pandemic. That's hard to be a messenger or something like that, but also to try to offer options of what we can do about it to minimize it. But people are reluctant to do that because that's not the way we do it. We've set it up to do it this way. Well, in a public health crisis, you know, you don't get to go to that crisis with what you want. You have to go to with what you got. And so we're trying very hard right now to help people see that option. That a reason I bring that up as an example is because I'm not doing a very good job of taking care of myself. I probably live on adrenaline right now and have for a long time. When you're doing media, which unfortunately a lot of the big draw media is early in the morning. So when I was on CBS this morning at 6 o'clock, I had to be up and out the door by 5:15, had to get all my stuff ready by 4, and I will be on TV tonight till 11. And that happens day after day after day. So I don't do it necessarily as well as sleep, but I do have a goal in mind that when this is all over with one day, I am going to go crawl in a cave and wake up 7 years later and see what my beard looks like and try to deal with it. But, you know, it's what public health was meant to do. We're, you know, we are the grease that's moving the wheels of prevention and trying to address this very horrible, horrible situation. So I feel very fortunate that we're where we are in terms of working on this. The SIDRAP team is nothing short of remarkable. Our news coverage has been received widely around the world. I do a weekly podcast that now has over 300,000 plus downloads a week. And, you know, I think our team in general, like the data we just put together on this issue around the testing, has really, you know, been important in terms of the national, international discussions. On Wednesday, we're going to be releasing a letter that has been delivered today to the White House lead on coronavirus, Tony Fauci at NIH and Rochelle Walensky at CDC, about how the U.S. government has to come modern with the idea of respiratory protection. There are far too many of the old paradigms of, you know, droplet transmission when aerosols, we know, are a very, very important part of it. Why is that important? Because until CDC brings that on board and adopts that, OSHA can't enforce it. If OSHA can't enforce it, this is why we've had so many workers out there becoming infected, because they have not had adequate respiratory protection because OSHA says you don't need it. Well, they didn't say you don't really need it. What they say is we can't enforce it because we don't have the authority because CDC hasn't yet adopted it. And so I'm part of a large, well, there's 13 of us. I'm the one that actually sent the letter, but there's 13 of us from around the United States that are aerobiologists, industrial hygienists, epidemiologists, et cetera, that are doing this. So it seems like every day there's another new issue or crisis, which, you know, that can get old sometimes. So, but the final piece, I just have to say, unlike John, who has done it really well in terms of the bubbling, you know, I really, really miss my grandkids. I had no idea how much I'd miss my grandkids. I can't tell you how hard it is. This year was notably hard. For the last 35 years, I've read the Polar Express to my kids on Christmas Eve, the first year it came out. And I've done that even as they grew older and into adults. We still did it. They humored me. You know, like, let's go. Humor Dad, we'll read the Polar Express again this year. And then when the grandkids came, you know, it was a wonderful situation. And last year, a year ago, the oldest two grandkids actually helped me read it. Well, this year I had to do it by Zoom. And that was really hard. It was still got it in, but it was really hard. So that's the thing I have to say has been the hard. It's not the sleep. You know, it's not the pressure, it's missing that ability to be with family. And of course, I couldn't, my daughter is a neonatologist who has to be at work, you know, wasn't vaccinated until very recently. And my son and his wife, because of the kids they have, kids are in daycare, et cetera, they are also couldn't bubble up. So in order to protect their dad, we had to keep it a distance.
Thanks, Mike, and thanks, John. Thanks for sharing that. It's hard. That's a harsh reality for sure. At this point, do any of the interns want to pop in and ask a follow-up question? I have some of the questions you sent ahead of time, but I'm giving you the chance right now to pop in. Okay.
You know, I'll make a point though, you know, on this whole thing, which I think is a interesting one. The technology, you can see the two stories, my story and Michael's story, and the technology makes possible both the ability to bubble up. I never thought as a dean I would be able to continue to do my job on this screen, this box in here, but it's been just amazing what we've been able to do. And one of the challenges that we have with the School of Public Health is that it's so fragmented across the campus, the Twin City campus. I mean, it's literally 3 miles and 10 different buildings. It's ridiculous, you know. We're not even one of the largest colleges in the university. But I've had comments back from students and staff and faculty. We've done community forums and things like that, and the technology has really paid off. I've had people say, I've never felt so in touch with the school and everything that's going on everywhere that I can never get to than I do right now. That, you know, so all of those things are on the upside. The downside is, you know, very much Michael's role as a public health scientist and as a public health advocate and as somebody who works with the media. I mean, he's on the media's schedule. He's not on his own schedule. He said that when he came online. And that creates an enormous number of challenges, because your life ends up not becoming your own anymore. And, you know, and the only thing, I mean, Michael and I've talked about this, but the thing that keeps Michael going and a lot of other folks like Tony Fauci is the fact that they know that they need to be there. They need to be talking about public health all the time as best we can. And they need to be a counterbalance to all the lies and conspiracy theories and disinformation and misinformation. And that's as much of a pandemic going on right now as COVID itself.
Yeah. And I would just compliment him for, you said it so well, John. Thank you. You nailed it. That's exactly right.
So some of the things people have said, and some of the questions we'll weave together here, but Mike, people have said, well, you were born for this. And what are you going to do when that wave's over? Like, you were born for this. And I wonder sometimes, the interns, you know, what do you feel you were born for? And Mike, how many decades ago did you think you were born for this? You know, any thoughts about your career and how it built up, both of you, to where it is today? If there were two or three things you would have done differently, if you were where these interns are now, what would those be? What might those be?
Well, you know, I'd say, first of all, never pass up an opportunity, no matter what age you are, to take advantage of an opportunity. You know, I came to the university in 1975. And at that time, infectious diseases were all but dead and gone. And people would ask me, why do you want to go into that horse and buggy stuff? There's several people at the U who had any interest in infectious diseases. And I was able, in the second week here, because of who I roomed with, I got a job as an intern at the State Health Department, where four interns and two bachelor's level people ran the infectious disease program. And we had a major encephalitis outbreak, a viral encephalitis from mosquito outbreak, and I got a job there. Well, to make a long story short, 2 years later, I was running that place. Which was crazy, and still teaching. And I've been at the U nonstop now for 45 plus years. And I have to say that opportunity was the gift of a lifetime. I can't imagine being anywhere else but the University of Minnesota. You know, it's been a wonderful, wonderful experience with School of Public Health. You know, guys like John, where we've had such support. And so I think that I would just say that sometimes you don't realize something that happens to you today may have a lifetime of impact. Second of all, I think the best training that I've gotten for this situation I'm in right now actually didn't come from education. It didn't even come from necessarily everyday life. For reasons I still don't understand, you can say I'm crazy, I'm nuts. I was born and raised in Northeast Iowa in a county that didn't have one lake in it at all. None. This is all hill. We had the Mississippi River. And I, in my early adult life, became an English Channel swimmer. And when you try to swim a body of water that by the time you get done swimming, it's 40 plus miles in cold, freezing water, you have to ask yourself, what's wrong with you, first of all? But the second thing you have to remember is that when you start out, that second hour, you are going to feel horrible. And you got to get it in your head, but I only have 12 more hours to go. And it's that mindset of being able to discipline yourself, you know, to do that. I used to swim Lake Minnetonka from end to end as practice. You know, that was 29 miles. And I remember there were days that when I did that one, I got halfway into it. I said, this is practice. I'm done. I'm quitting. And then you couldn't do it. And so I kind of use that same mindset here right now. I said back in April, as John well knows, on Meet the Press, when I was asked, you know, the cases were coming down in New York at that time, looked like things were getting better. And people were all trying to say, oh boy, this was a bad one, but we dodged a bullet. And I said, we're only in the earliest foothills. We haven't even gotten close to the mountains yet. And they're a long ways off. And people looked at me like I was nuts, and they might've been right, but at least on that statement, I was right. And I think that having that mindset has helped a lot. And I've tried to share that with SIDRAP so that we don't burn ourselves out, that people don't get into the place where it's almost over and done with. The variants right now have thrown curveballs like you can't believe. I mean, I almost have felt like days in the past month, it's like March of 2000 again, you know, at the beginning. It's like the whole pandemic started over again. And so that's the other part I would just say is sometimes what your mind does, what your head does, can be every bit as important what your brain does and your heart. And so I think that's one valuable lesson I've had to learn. And I'm in this for the long haul. And I would just close it by saying, you know, I as I said, I work with the most incredible people in the world at SIDRAP. We have an amazing team there. And so every day I think about them, but you know what? The reason I can get up early every morning and go to bed late every night is because I also think about what does this pandemic mean for my grandkids? And, you know, it's a really easy thing to motivate yourself when you realize, you know, this is about my kids and grandkids.
So I would second the concept of opportunity. Be open to opportunities. There's some people in the world, and my dad was one of them. So my dad was a journalist and editor for years and years and years.
And a wonderful man.
Yes, I knew thank
him.
You.
I loved him.
Yeah, and in the St. Paul newspapers. And he was unusual because, you know, he knew in the fourth grade what he wanted to do for his whole life. And he did it. He was a journalist. He even in World War II, when he was a foot soldier, he was the historian for the regiment that he was in. So he's one of those really, really lucky people. And I always admire those people. You know, they know exactly what they want. They found it early and so forth. Me, not so much. I studied for the priesthood, Roman Catholic priesthood initially. And at the same time, I just couldn't avoid journalism. So even though I'm an English major, I started at the university in 1973, just after or during the Watergate. I was actually working on a master's degree during the Watergate era. And the journalism stuff runs in my genes, and I couldn't avoid it. So I moved in that direction. And in the 70s, while Michael was becoming the state epidemiologist and doing his service, I was working as a journalist. And that's where he met my dad, because long about the early 80s, when HIV/AIDS began to emerge, Michael was the state epidemiologist, right place, right time. And I remember when he and my dad had first gotten together, because my dad came home at one point and said to me, he said, you know, there's this this guy, Michael Osterholm, over at the state health department. You know, he's got to be like 20 years old. I just can't believe it, you know. And he knows so much about this, and it's so important. And what was really interesting was that they were forming a relationship, which was so important for the press, the Pioneer Press, to be able to do a better job in reporting what was going on with AIDS, HIV. And I do remember my dad in particular saying that Michael's influence was so important in understanding how serious this was, and understanding that this wasn't about gay people. This was about people and behavior. And of course, when the whole thing started to erupt, there was an enormous amount of prejudice against the LGBTQ people, enormous prejudice and so forth. But I gotta tell you, you know, Michael will never say this, but I will. The St. Paul newspapers under my dad won 3 Pulitzer Prizes. Yep. One of those Pulitzer Prizes was specifically for AIDS in the Heartland,
yep,
which was covering a pair of farmers who were gay and dealing with AIDS, HIV. And they did it with such sensitivity that they won a Pulitzer Prize. And I don't believe that would have happened had they not had the relationship with Michael and had they not really fully understood what this was all about. I throw that out to you because I want to make the other point that Michael will not make, but I will. Communication from people in public health with expertise and talent, even though we're in a world filled with lies and disinformation, is like a beacon. It's a beacon. You know you can always rely on Tony Fauci, Mike Osterholm, and a whole variety of other people. They will tell you what they know. They will be the realist to tell you what they know to be the truth. And they will also remind you that science changes. Science doesn't always, it isn't the be-all and the end-all. Realism is understanding that. So I just want to throw that out because as you get into your careers and so forth, and whatever aspect of health it is, whether it's public health or vet med or whatever it may be, just keep that in mind. Develop the ability to talk to average, everyday people, not in an expert, arrogant way, but in a way that they can really get it and understand it. And that's one of Michael's gifts, by the way. Michael has this ability to just find a metaphor that people can go, oh, the house is on fire. Oh, yeah. Boy, that's for sure true. You know, everyone can relate to that.
Thanks, John.
Well, thank you. Can I just add a comment to that?
Please. First of all, I
think thank you for your very kind comments. I have to say that the Pioneer Press deserved everything they got. But the story that for me demonstrated incredible courage and perseverance, and it showed the power of the media. And this is why the media is so important, as John just pointed out. And that's why I think he and I have this natural relationship, because journalism, I see, is part of the bedrock of modern epidemiology. Back in the early 1980s, when this HIV was all emerging, as state epidemiologist, I came on information of young males who had been infected, and their sex partners in many instances were Catholic priests. And I have to tell you that it was a very troubling situation. At the time, the commissioner of health was Sister Amadonna Ashton, who in the end turned out to be the most magnificent health commissioner we could have ever had. As a Catholic nun, She came up through the ranks as a social worker. She'd worked in East St. Louis. I mean, there was nothing she hadn't seen, nothing she hadn't been threatened by. It was amazing. So we went to the Archbishop at the time to share this information. Something, you know, had to be done. And this was before the pedophile issue had come up at all. And he just flat turned us down and said, you know, kind of, thank you, bye. So, you know, I'm very, very, very conscious of the Data Practices Act and the fact that I couldn't disclose, you know, non-public information. But I was able to provide enough information to the same reporter who won the Pulitzer Prize for AIDS in the Heartland, Jackie Bonashinsky. And she wrote the very first story that cracked that thing wide open.
Yeah.
And it disclosed for the first time the pedophilia issue in the Catholic Church, but on top of AIDS. And it also points out sometimes in public health, what we want to do and how we do it means we need team members we don't think are natural parts of our lives. And that's why I think journalism can be such a critical, critical piece. Let me just give you one layer, one more on that. You know, I saw for years my chronic disease colleagues who did so much to educate the public to try to deal with the issue of smoking and chronic disease. And frankly, we made inroads, but not much. You know, Surgeon General's report surely helped, et cetera. It was when the attorney generals of the country got together, and particularly one lawyer in the Twin Cities, Mike Cerisi, and the group there took on big tobacco. Those lawyers had more impact on the overall ability to regulate and educate about smoking than any other group. And it was a stark reminder, who would have thought a lawyer, you know, particularly a liability lawyer, or, you know, would be such a critical part of this team. So one of the things I also learned early on in my career, your teams of people who may end up supporting you, what you do, how you do it, where you do it, may not at all seem like what you'd see if you went and sat in an epidemiology class at the university. And you have to be prepared for that. Find the partners who can make a difference. Find the partners who will be those natural alliance kinds of individuals. And that is such an important part. And I think that's why John's skills in journalism play so well in public health, because that's one of those natural alliance places that is really, really important. So I'm sorry, Carolyn, to take that over. I just had to tell that story because to me, today, the thing that I will always feel like we did more than any place else to further was the whole issue of the pedophile, which, you know, was such a tragic situation.
So yeah, what I appreciate about sharing, and I'm glad that you did, is that you have emphasized team, you've emphasized the interprofessional aspect of this, and you've done it while also bringing up some of the very difficult and controversial issues that we've had to deal with in society and in public health and in health for quite a few decades. One of the things we wanted to tease out with you was really this this way of handling health issues, disagreements, politics, media. When you put all of this together, at the core, you believe something today and you speak about it. Your opinion and your perspective might change. You have a team around you to help you, but it's a challenging dynamic. There's a lot of moving parts right now. C.S. Lewis used to talk about how much he enjoyed debate and dissension. And I think there's a place for that. So you talked about having a debate tonight. There's so many pieces here. Where do you want to jump off and branch off with? Teamness, debate, dissension, yeah. All of that.
Well, let me just say, and John, I'm sure will support this, is you can have disagreements and you can be on the other side of an issue and you can even be opponents, but you never have to be enemies. Right. And that is such an important lesson. I have to tell you, I mean, a good example of this was for many, 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 many years in public health, there was one North Star that was absolutely true. Influenza vaccines will protect you 70 to 90% of the time. Get your flu shot. And we had data early in 2009 with the influenza pandemic that occurred then that, wait a minute, these shots aren't working nearly that well. And I was part of the dogma, okay? But once we started realizing, wait a minute, this isn't working like everybody said it was, this 40 at that time, almost 50-year-old technology, eggs makes it an eggs, et cetera. We published a paper in 2011 in The Lancet that, John remembers this, that I came as close to being labeled a Andrew Wakefield anti-vaccine guy as could be imagined. Andrew Wakefield's a guy that actually said that measles causes autism and it was all fabricated data, et cetera. And I said, no, influenza vaccines don't work like this. Some years they may not work at all. And people wouldn't accept it. It was terrible. I mean, it was very personal. One of the groups that were the loudest and most, vigorously defending the vaccines was CDC. And there's a group at CDC that in particular did that. You know what? We never made it personal. I never let it get personal. We kept working with them, sharing it. They then set up a series of studies over subsequent years that now today are the basis for which we know our annual flu vaccine effectiveness. And within 3 years, they realized, oh my God, it's true. They're not working. We had years where one of the antigens literally was at 0% effectiveness. Some years, on average, if we got 50%, that was great. Well, why is that important? Because today's SIDRAP is leading what is called the influenza vaccine roadmap process, where for with WHO, the Gates Foundation, Wellcome Trust, CDC, everybody, NIH, we're leading this, coming up with brand new universal flu vaccines. And guess who some of the strongest supporters are? Some of the people who have made major contributions were that same group at CDC, one person in particular, who at the time in 2009 knew we were completely wrong, and today is the strongest supporter we have. And I think the message here is that always do your best to separate the personal and the professional, and never take for granted the personal, but also never add anger. And one of the things I think is the worst parts of professional work today is email. I hate email for that reason. Far too many people in a moment of an emotion will write an email that if they had just given one more hour, they would have reconsidered and not sent it. But you can't unring a bell. And today, I think, if anything, I try to teach the students, the interns, if you have an email that is written in anger, an email that is accusatory, or an email that undermines someone else's position, put it away for an hour, for an evening, for a day, and go back and reread it. And ask yourself, how would I do if I got this? And I think that's been really, really an important part for my career to see. The last piece I'll say is I'm from this little farm town in Iowa, and this goes right to John's point. I judge what I say to the public on whether or not it'll play at the 10 o'clock coffee club at the S&D Cafe in Waukon, Iowa. And if it doesn't play at the 10 o'clock coffee club, forget it. It's not going to go. You got to make it work there or it's not going to work.
You know, there's one other lesson I would pull out of what Michael said in reference to the influenza vaccine effectiveness. You know, when you're working in health, whether it's medicine or vet med or public health, you're going to be working in team settings.
Yeah.
Beware of group think. So it you know, teams are great. I mean, I'm not saying I'm not anti-team and I'm not a rogue or anything like that. I'm very much in favor of teams because you get so much insight going on. But beware of the group think process. And once those folks at CDC understood why vaccines were so variably effective with influenza, and you understand the process of where you first, you know, get the sample of the influenza in the Australia, Australasia, and sometimes by the time it gets to South and Central America, it's mutated already. And yet, because of the 50-year-old technology, you've already started to make the vaccine based on an influenza virus that doesn't exist anymore. It's now mutated. So and then when you understand that process, then you go, of course, now we understand why the effectiveness was so variably different. So my point of that is that we have to be careful in the health area and in the public health area of blindly accepting what everyone knows is true. And by saying that, I'm certainly not intending to throw any science out the window. I am intending to emphasize the value of science, which is, it's not a destination, it is a journey.
Yep.
And that's always changing and shifting. And you've got to be, if you're going to be an effective scientist in anywhere, you've got to be open-minded. Okay.
Yeah.
So just keep that in mind.
This is fabulous. I love that you're talking about not taking things personally, not making an enemy, but really being able to disagree. Mike, you haven't always been right, have you? Do we have any stories we want to share about any life mistakes or regrets or do-overs?
You know, I think learning humility is important. When you're young and you want to take on the world, humility isn't necessarily one of your first qualities. And I think that's something that I've found to be one of the greatest gifts of life is to learn humility. I think the second thing that is really important, and I can't say that enough, and that is always taking care of the team. The team, there's no I in team. And that's why when you look at SIDRAP, I feel so blessed the fact that the senior leadership team has been there for 35 years or more together. We've been together. And, you know, that's because we all take care of each other besides do our work. And I think that's priceless. You can't do that. I think the other part of it is I don't want to confuse people by saying, you know, being nice and kind and all those things doesn't mean you can't be tough as a bulldog. You know, right now in this one dose, two dose issue, I am not going to let go. I got my teeth dug in tight because I see thousands and thousands of lives that will be at risk in the next 6 to 12 weeks if we don't pursue this. And I'll be damned if I'm going to let people, just for policy reasons, derail that discussion. And so sometimes, as Sir Winston Churchill once said, sometimes, you know, when I look at this world, he says, play for more than you can afford to lose and learn how to play the game. And one of the things I've learned is how precious human life is. And so, you know, I'll go to the mat on something like that. I can still do it respectfully. Tonight, I hope I'm going to do that on CNN. I'm going to basically be tough, you know. Yeah, I'm not going to, you know, how should I say it? I'm not going to back down. But at the same time, I've gotten there because of the science. You know, be your worst critic. Always ask yourself, does this really make sense? You know, and you asked me this, Carolyn, and I'm trying to be humble here about it, but I've always believed you're as good as your last case. And if you screw that up, you're good for life. They'll remind you. And I've been involved in a lot of calls, tough ones. If I had a nickel for every time when I was at the state health department, somebody threatened to try to get me fired, you know, I could go on a long vacation. And you know what? Our group has never been wrong. But that's not out of luck. And that's surely not out of arrogance. Mm-hmm. It's out of always asking yourself, is there any other reason for this? Is there any other data that could address this? How sure are you of it? And, you know, you just have to, you know, when I called the pandemic on January 20th, well, a year ago, I wrote the document that said this is going to be a global pandemic. Man, you can't know how much negative press I got. And then shortly thereafter, I published an op-ed in the New York Times saying that and said, getting on with it, you know, 6 weeks before WHO declared it a pandemic. A week after I did the New York Times, JAMA did a full page cartoon showing, going down the list of all the qualities, characteristics, and issues around influenza and coronavirus, and coming up at the bottom showing that influenza seasonally was much more important than coronavirus, and we were misplacing our emphasis on the coronavirus. Yeah, that hurt. That hurt, you know, because it was aimed at me. The whole thing was aimed at me. That's one where you just have to back off. But you know what? You had to be convicted. I knew why I said what I said and what our team knew to say what we said, and we didn't back down, you know? And I think so I would just say, you know, humility, never taking yourself too seriously, always ask yourself the hardest questions, and that, take care of the team. And if you do that, you know, you'll be right. You'll be right.
Thank you. Anyone want to pipe in at this point? Mike, you started out talking about the debate tonight. What's the argument you expect, and what are your main counterpoints?
Well, Paul Offit, who is a very, you know, well-known, recognized vaccine expert, but, you know, I believe Paul sometimes will put things out there without data or whatever to support it. And for example, he has put out there that these vaccines don't work well after one dose, even though his mentor, Stanley Plotkin, wrote the paper in JAMA or in CI Clinical Infectious Disease right now saying they do. Yeah. And so I'll remind Paul of that tonight when he says they don't, because people will doubt that we should be using a single dose for any period of time if they don't work, because they do. The second thing is people have a very hard time anticipating the future. You know, even after having made a series of predictions that came true, and John's aware of this, in September, I got hammered hard by the media. And in fact, just this past weekend, I got an email to this extent where someone has decided, a group of them got together, and they're going to try to have manslaughter charges filed against me for the fact that more people have died from suicide because of my scary, scary predictions, and that I'm responsible for their suicides. I mean, I actually get this stuff, okay? But back in September, when we were at 26,000 cases a day, we could see this happening, unfolding. And I said, we'll be at 200,000 cases by Thanksgiving. And people couldn't fathom that, because remember, 70,000 had been the highest we'd been at. And now we're down to 26, and everybody was ready to say it's done. We hit 200,000 cases on November 8th. We got back down to 150,000 cases a day by the end of November. And I saw this whole change, what's happened in the southern states, and said, we'll be at 300,000 cases by middle of January. We hit 300,000 cases a day on January 8th. And so people kind of forget that. So now I'm sitting here saying that this B.1.1.7 variant is going to be the darkest days of the pandemic. We are, I think the next 6 to 14 weeks are going to be horrible, much worse than we've had. Well, if you don't believe that, then you don't have to worry about the vaccine debate. Okay, because then you just let it roll out as it is. And do I have the data at this point to say this is what's going to happen? No. Do I have an argument I think that's worthy of debate? Yes. Look what every country in Europe and the Middle East has had happen once this virus did what it's doing right now in the US, the level it's at. Okay, we are just weeks from this just exploding. And but Paul, people like Paul can get up there and say, well, come on, this isn't going to happen. We have vaccines out there. You know, they think somehow by vaccinating a few percent of the population, it'll suddenly stop the pandemic. It won't. You know, they believe that, well, you know, there's herd immunity. Come on. We, our data, all of our data says that there's no more than 30% of the US population infected with this virus that would have any residual protection going forward. 70% are still out there. That's the dead wood or the wood that's waiting to be burned by this coronavirus forest fire. So that's hard to get that across in a forum like CNN tonight. But it's, you got to get the people with you to understand, why are you talking about this? Because nobody wants to give up their second dose. So here's what I do. I say, okay, imagine it's your mom and dad sitting across the table. They're over 65 years old. Both of them have underlying health conditions. And I'm the physician. I'm the public health doctor. I'm whoever sitting across the table, and I have two doses of vaccine, two doses. Okay. And that I will right now determine that you can get two or you can get two, but if I do that, one of you are going to get none. Or I can give one to each. And these are the data that we have to support the fact that there is protection after a single dose. It's before the second dose is ever given, we're at 90 some percent protection levels. And so then it gets very different when you say, do you want your mom and dad, want them to get it, not the other? Or do you want both of them to get one? And that's where it becomes very different in terms of understanding. It's very abstract till you get to that point. And that's what I will try to do tonight is share, we've got to have this. And all I'm asking for is an immediate emergency review of all the data we have to say, do first doses actually offer the protection that we believe they do? And if they don't, look at, I'm gone, okay? But I know that the data is there to support they will. And you can't hide behind, just follow the science. That's a slogan. That's not a deliberate scientific act. So that's where I would go tonight. So that's the discussion tonight.
I got to say, you know, one of the important things about this, and this is what I always loved about public health. When I first got into public health, working on my doctorate, I realized I was like a kid in a candy store. I could go down the hall and I could visit a cardiologist. I could visit a virologist. I could go visit, believe it or not, an anthropologist, you know, and as well as card-carrying epidemiologists and all those other things. It is a multidisciplinary. And the way I got into it was because I came in with communication and social and behavioral science. And that was the last field that public health had yet to embrace. And they started that in the 70s and in the 80s, especially after AIDS, HIV emerged. And the reason for that was because they recognized that a vaccine for AIDS, HIV, I remember Jim Curran, who was at CDC at the time, basically saying in 1982, we're not going to see a vaccine for at least a decade and maybe longer. Well, he was right, except that it was more the longer part. But the point is that with public health having all of these other disciplines, you learn not to think of public health problems only in your own narrow mindset. And I think, you know, a virologist who is focused on vaccines looks at this, and I sometimes have this challenge with a few people in the med school. They are, you know, vaccines are wonderful, and the vaccines that have been developed, fantastic. But the story doesn't end there. The story is about education. The story is about public policy. The story is about human behavior. And all of those things can be and have been blocks to fulfilling the vaccination advantages. And other things like, and Michael's SIDRAP Center focuses on this a lot, this is the issue of supply chains.
Yep.
And as soon as you start talking supply chains, you're talking about global networks and economics. As soon as you start talking about people being afraid to take a vaccine, you're talking about human behavior and all of the persuasion and education that needs to go into it. So that's a critical thing. This isn't just, oh, here's another coronavirus. Hey, we have a vaccine. Problem solved. Let's all go home. It's not that simple. And I would say public health is one of those multidisciplinary fields that gets that. And we need lots of people that are from these different disciplines. We need economists. We need social and behavioral scientists. We need physicians. We need epidemiologists. We need all of these people working together because it's upstream prevention. And, you know, when you go upstream, it's complicated. No question.
Yep.
Well said.
One thing, by the way, one last thing I want to leave you with, and it's this idea. In public health, you get what you don't pay for. You think about that for a moment in terms of the investment or lack thereof in public health. If you don't invest in public health, then you get what you don't invest in. And that's been a challenge. You know, we tried to solve in the 20th century, we tried to solve tuberculosis, got to a point where we said, well, that looks pretty good. We did the same with mosquito control and malaria. Well, that looks pretty good. So, you know, we don't want to spend any more money on that. Guess what's happened in both cases? They come roaring back. So that's the other problem and the other challenge we have with public health is how much are we willing to invest in upstream prevention in such a way that downstream really bad things happen less often. So,
yeah, thanks, John.
Other questions from people?
There's a couple of comments here.
I see those.
And Mike, I think it's really this interesting question. Had the variants not presented themselves, we'd be on a different pathway than it sure sounds like we are. Dr. Fauci is talking about herd immunity needing to be up around 70, 80%. Your argument for one vaccine in as many people as quickly as possible. What's your best guess if we took that approach or didn't in terms of hitting some herd immunity and getting to the other side?
Yeah, we're not even close to herd immunity, and no one really knows what that number is. I have lots of conversations with some of my most, brilliant epidemiologist colleagues, Mark Lipsitch at Harvard, et cetera. And we don't really know what this is. I think it actually, if anything, has gone up a bit just because of the issue around the increased transmissibility. You know, that I think has been a big issue. The other thing I would say is that what we're trying to do right now has nothing to do with herd immunity. We're trying to take the highest risk group for severe illness, death, hospitalization, those over 65. 80% of all the deaths have occurred in those over 65. And so what we're trying to do is minimize the impact there. That won't even create herd immunity at all. That may protect that group as much as we can, but that's all we're trying to do. So, at this point, that's my sum total is that what the other thing we may never hit is herd immunity as it relates to the fact that if the viruses are able to avoid immune detection, i.e., these variants we have right now that are escaping both natural disease and virus and vaccine-related protection, you know, that's going to be hard to ever get herd immunity possibly, just like we don't ever dream of getting herd immunity with influenza as such because it's changing all the time. So we have a lot yet to do, at this point. So that's where I'm at.
Yep. Thank you. I'm going to open it up again. We've got, I would say, just a few more minutes and see if anyone wants to jump on. And if not, there's another comment in the chat box about our triple pandemic. And I've heard triple pandemic and different things thrown in the mix. So I've heard triple pandemic being our economic downfall, the SARS-CoV-2, racism. Some folks have referenced mental health. Anyone want to reflect on those things and how we're trying to manage and tackle a lot of things going on at the same time here in health and healthcare administration, and certainly public health?
Well, I'll step in a little bit on this. I think even before COVID, these other challenges have been there, and of course, emerging infectious diseases has been a major issue going on for a long time as well. In some ways, you could argue that what happened sometime in late 2019 was a sort of a perfect storm. The conditions all came together to create a perfect storm. COVID was raging. Mr. Floyd was murdered. And that amplified the 400-year-old hurt of racism in the United States. COVID also underscored that Black, Brown, and Indigenous people were hit much more by it, worse than was true of many white folks. And I would say that the issues of isolation certainly have enhanced mental health challenges, and we've been seeing some of those from the opioid epidemic and other things along those lines. So many of these things, the conditions underlying each of these areas that Vanessa correctly identified, these things came together and I think have been extraordinarily amplified. I don't know if you read the Washington Post, but if you do, there's a great article in there today, and it touches on not only the current pandemic, but the past pandemics, about what happens when you get pandemics. And it's a really important thing. You get an explosion of extremism politically. Yep. You get an explosion of conspiracy theories. And the point is that you get a lot of mental health challenges, which is where a lot of these things actually are coming from. So there is a dynamic about a pandemic caused by an organism you can't even see. And in fact, we're not even sure it's an organism. We know it's a whole bunch of strings of RNA. But, you know, that's scary. And especially when you have to isolate and you have only yourself to talk to or think about. I think all of these things come together. There's no question that one of the things about a post-COVID world that we're going to have to deal with is all of the issues socially, in terms of racial justice, and certainly in terms of mental health. Those are going to be major issues going forward. Mike.
Yeah, Bob.
Oops, did we lose him?
Oh, we might have lost him.
Oh, dear.
That's quite all right.
He was going to say something great. I know.
I know, yeah. He might pop back on. Yeah. Comments, thoughts at this point? I know there are a couple other questions that were sent. Let me pause for 10 seconds at least and give you a chance to speak up.
I just had a quick follow-up question to what was discussed right now. So as students in healthcare, well, we've always believed that there's a sacred component to science, which is past politics. And now that we are entering clinics and, you know, we are interacting with patients, we are getting to see like different kinds of patients. We have patients who are understanding of the pandemic, understanding of the situation, but then there are others who genuinely believe that this is a hoax, and with all the restrictions, it's just something that is being imposed on them. So how can we work together as future healthcare workers to sort of combat this misinformation? Is there any way we can work along with technology, journalism, to kind of check this? Because, I mean, it's a different thing to debate, you know, between Medicare for all versus private insurance. But where do you start the conversation when people are flat out denying a full-blown pandemic?
Well, you know, that is it's a really important issue that you're talking about. And I don't pretend to have the answer for you, but I can point you in certain kinds of directions. I think one of the things, if you're going to be especially a healthcare provider, a clinician, a nurse, a physician, and so forth, I think you really need to have some skills as far as counseling and things of that kind are concerned. You got to be very clear when you're working with people to be empathetic and sympathetic and work with them. If they're coming into you as you're a healthcare provider and they're coming in and they're hostile with respect to, oh, I don't believe any of this other stuff. You know, it's really important to try to work with them. If they're that hostile, I mean, it's you can relate to them by saying, look, I'm taking care of myself as well. This is not false. This is a real thing. And if you get it, it's not good. And I think there are ways that you can work with them, because otherwise, why would they be coming into a situation with you as a clinician and then telling you that, well, this stuff is all crazy? Well, I don't think they actually believe that. Yeah. At least not down to the tips of their toes, they don't believe it. And I think it's really important. Yeah, but again, you have to treat people as kindly as you can and just help them, you know, build that empathy for them and so on. I think the saddest thing about what's happened with this, and by the way, it did happen in 1918 with the great influenza that happened at that time. And it was the same thing. We had people that, you know, they had conspiracy theories. There were people that didn't wear masks. There were people that, you know, believed it was a hoax and so forth. So this is not new. This is part of, maybe I would say, the dark side of human behavior and so forth. It's just part of who we are as humans. And being able to deal with that, I think, effectively is something that healthcare providers probably need a lot more training in the area of clinical counseling, how one does that. I don't mean to turn you into psychiatrist or anything like that, but I think you do need to figure out how to develop those things. I could tell you what won't work in a situation. If somebody comes in with that idea and you say, no, you're wrong, the science shows that, you know, that's not going to work. You need to do it in a quite a different way. But anyway, I throw that out there because I do believe that these events that Vanessa has listed and described here, when you look at the confluence of all of those events, the basic reality is that there's going to be a lot of post-traumatic stress going on here. And when you think of it in those terms, and we're all different as people. For some of us, it's not as bad. For others, it's very bad. And it depends on who you are and your circumstances and everything else. But I think, I don't know, I guess if I could say anything to people who don't believe this stuff, it's, you know, back off and be kinder to people.
John, we have 1 minute left, and yeah. I love that you just said that. Give us some hope. Where do you see public health 20 years from now? What's the podcast these interns should be launching?
Well, I know where I'd like to see public health 20 years from now. I really think, you know, unfortunately, public health is in a bit of a shambles right now. It's been underfunded chronically. We've seen tens of thousands of people since the late 70s and early 80s have left public health. They don't work in public health. The funding has dropped, but it's state governments. And in the United States of America, we honestly really don't have much of a public health system in the way that we really need it. I think the big challenges are going to be, as we go on, how can we turn that around? How can we turn around the infrastructure that we need for public health? And by the way, I mean going upstream not merely sandbagging the rising river. That's, you know, you have to do some of that, but I mean really going upstream and looking at all of those factors that create the inequities in our society that are also, I would say, sources of political animosity and so forth. And I think that one of the ways, I mean, a major issue is we're going to have to come to some reckoning with the racism in this country that has resulted in the disparities that we see all around us that have magnified not only infectious disease, but have certainly magnified chronic disease as well. So we need more people in public health, and we need people that are committed to a better world. A world in which everybody has opportunity, and if you remember your basic Maslow's hierarchy, a world that takes care of all the basics so that everybody can self-actualize at the top of that pyramid. That's the kind of world that we need that provides opportunity and provides a life worth living to everybody.
Thank you, Dean Finnegan. Very,
my pleasure.
Very great way to end the night.
Yeah, so there is hope. It will get better.
It will. Thank you, everyone. This concludes our fireside chat. Have a great evening.
Thank you for listening. Let us know what you gained from this conversation by writing a quick review. Please share this podcast with others, subscribe for future conversations, and check out our other episodes. Explore health sciences at the University of Minnesota at health.umn.edu.